Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Tom Merritt and Leo Laporte. Episode 30, recorded November 2nd, 2011. Eric Reese. Triangulation is brought to you by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, so you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Check it out in the 2012 Ford Fiesta and at Ford.com/technology. And by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, visit Netflix.com/twit. It's time for Triangulation, the show in which Tom Merritt and I pick somebody who's really smart and try to learn a thing or two. Right?
Yes. They do their best. Every once in a while we learn something.
Occasionally we learn. I hope you all at home.
Seeps through our hard heads.
This is actually a book that I've been wanting to read for some time because I feel that I am fumbling badly with the startup that I am running. It's called The Lean Startup. And it's actually really made waves in Silicon Valley. Everybody's reading it and talking about it. Eric Reese is here. Am I saying that right? Reese?
Yeah. Like the candy.
Yeah, like the Reese's.
Reese like the candy.
Reese Pieces. He is. He's actually started three different startups. You might know IMVU. Mm-hmm. What happened to IMVU? Did you sell it?
It's actually still going. It is a private and profitable company.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
CTO and founder. You're currently entrepreneur in residence at Harvard Business School. That's good. How did you do this book? Was it a lot of research, or did you write what you know? Like, here's how I screwed up.
Well,
you do that.
It's helpful to have screwed up a bunch of times because that gives you a lot of material to write about. But I actually enjoyed doing research for it also.
Because, a lot of case studies in here.
Yeah, I wanted to really show people the ideas in action.
Yeah.
And since, you know, I've been talking about these ideas for a couple of years now, there now are enough practitioners out there who have tried things and had themselves had some opportunities to fail and succeed and to tell those stories too, just to kind of show the diversity of like what entrepreneurship looks like today.
So what,
the different kinds of entrepreneurs that are putting these ideas to work.
What's the principal idea behind a lean startup?
The word lean comes from lean manufacturing, things like the Toyota production system that happened in Japan. And what I wanted to do is see if we could take some of those ideas that have been really effective in established companies and adapt them to the process of entrepreneurship. Because I really felt that the way I was taught to do entrepreneurship and new product development was totally haphazard, didn't work very well,
right.
Was really sloppy, and kept putting me in this situation where I would build amazing technology, build a great product, and then nobody would use it. So I was like, well, I guess I'm satisfied that I got to build something that was fun, but the whole point of building a new product is because you want people to engage with it. You want it to be successful. You want it to make money. Whatever your goal is, you want to change the world.
I mean, there's nothing new about starting businesses. We kind of exalt this whole idea of the entrepreneur, but people have been starting businesses since people have had businesses. What is different about modern entrepreneurship, and I presume particularly tech entrepreneurship?
Oh, yeah. It's really a democratization of access to entrepreneurship. It used to be that if you wanted to become an entrepreneur,
you had to have capital.
You had to own the means of production, yeah. Good old Karl Marx. Mm-hmm. Well, we live in a time where you can rent the means of production. How cool is that?
Yeah.
So if you want to start building a new business, it doesn't matter if it's in tech, in media, in fashion, in retail. Almost all of those businesses, you can start something relatively inexpensively and, more importantly, very quickly. So you don't have to first go build the factory, then design the thing. No, it's like first, you know, do the Kickstarter campaign to find out if customers want it.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, deliver your first prototypes based on rented factory time, you know, on a, you know, just-in-time fab, some kind that automatically produces the device. And then at that point, when you know that you have customers for sure, you know how much they're willing to pay, you know how much it costs to build a device, then you can think about, well, how do I use those facts to build a scalable business?
You're a tenant entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You just rent your space and go with the idea.
Boy, but that has changed everything because, I mean, you know, we have a restaurant next door that just went out of business. In the old days of starting a business, you're really throwing something up against the wall and hoping it sticks. You said, well, it looks like a good place to start a restaurant. I think I got a good menu. I'll put $1 million literally into this and cross my fingers.
Yeah.
So we're in a very different time where thousands of dollars is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And there are opportunities in so many areas, but it's particularly software is where you're seeing an amazing web and software.
For
right?
sure. I mean, that's my background. So right. I think that is, you know.
I mean, if you wanted to start a new computer company, there's some capitalization you got to have. But
oh,
if you want
to make semiconductors, yeah. physically manufacture things.
But if you want to start a website or a software service, it doesn't cost much at all. You use, you know, you can use EC3 and you know, you don't even have to own your computers.
Oh, no, you wouldn't want to.
You wouldn't want to.
All of your physical assets are actually liabilities.
Right.
Because they get in the way of you being able to act with agility, which one of the key concepts from Lean Startup is being able to pivot when you realize you've made a mistake or where some part of your business plan is invalidated. Instead of treating that like, oh, my God, it's a crisis. I can't believe I made a mistake. I got something wrong. We accept that as entrepreneurs.
You will.
You're going to get things wrong. It's going to be you're going to make mistakes. Your core, you know, business assumptions, some of them are going to be wrong. And that's not the end of the world. That doesn't have to be the end of your company unless you've, you know, built out all the web van distribution centers and you've gone to the press and you've launched and you've burned all your money.
And
on,
you've sponsored all the cup holders at Pac Bell Park.
Yeah, exactly. Right. If you put all that momentum behind something that is just a bunch of guesses, then, you know, you better hope the rocket ship lands in a good place. Otherwise, you can miss the moon by quite a lot.
So it really does parallel how software development nowadays works. It's iterative. With Ruby on Rails, you get something running, and then you say, how's that work? And you iterate, and you iterate. So you're saying startups today are iterative processes.
You got it exactly right. We actually advocate something called continuous deployment in the Lean Startup model, which is a specific mode of software development where we put software into production continuously as soon as it's written. So if you go to InView right now and you sat down and said, hey, I got an idea for a feature, let's code it up, boom, 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 code it on my desk, we'd say, all right, 20 minutes later, it's live in production.
Wow.
And we can do that without taking the site down, introducing bugs, causing a lot of problems, because there's a whole methodology to preventing mistakes. It's akin to the old Toyota production system. Remember that famous Andon cord? You know, a worker pulls a cord, if they see even the smallest defect, the whole line stops and you address it. So we have that equivalent facility in our production process so that if somebody makes a mistake, if a developer tries to break something, instead of automatically inflicting that on customers, our system can detect that we made a mistake, automatically revert it, shut down the line, figure out what went wrong, and fix it.
But that sounds like a... Really?
Yeah.
Sounds like a pipe dream. We really have that?
We really have that. No, it's totally real.
It really works?
Yeah, we really do that.
Is it Rails? What is it?
InView is from 2004, so our infrastructure is really, it's archaic by modern standards.
It's PHP?
And a little bit of Java, a little bit of C, a little bit of Python. I mean, there wasn't an overarching framework, but we were able to build up all this infrastructure piece by piece, incremental investment for incremental return, because we were following this process that always said, let's always be maximizing how fast we can learn new things.
So I like that.
The infrastructure of something like continuous deployment, it's not really rocket science. Most engineers I sit down, if I can get them past, well, that'll never work. So no, just pretend hypothetically that it would work. How would you build it? Most people know how to do it. But most people can't understand why. What's wrong with just launching once a week, once a month, you know, once a quarter? Remember in the old days when the year the product came out was in the name of the product?
Right.
Like
Windows 98.
95, right?
Yeah.
Like that's the year. So that tells you something about the speed at which software used to be delivered at most once a year, or else you'd have a name.
Well, it's still that way for things like Windows, but not for web software.
But you talk a lot about that for any product.
Focusing the features, too, and keeping the features limited. So you're not throwing everything in there. That seems to feed off of this idea of being able to release faster,
exactly,
right? Because you're not doing too much.
And therefore, your opportunities to be wrong are minimized. We call it the minimum viable product, or MVP. And part of one of the biggest sources of waste in my life, in all entrepreneurs' life, is the time you spend arguing with your co-founders about what features absolutely have to be in version one, and what could you live without, what bugs do you absolutely have to fix. I mean, we'll talk about an endless and unwinnable argument.
Right.
Minimum viable product says, no, there's actually a clear standard for what should be in the version one. It should be the absolute minimum necessary to learn whatever we want to learn with this experiment. And so we're reconceiving product development as a set of scientific experiments that are designed to help us learn something important.
So Agile is about being able to fail and recover from the failure, and more importantly, learn from that failure so you can iterate and do the next generation and the next generation and the next generation, slowly moving closer and closer to the perfect product.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Zeno's paradox. You never get there.
You never get there.
Yeah.
Well, and what happens is, One of the misconceptions, when people get the religion about this, it's all about iteration and data, and you know that's all good stuff.
Right.
But people sometimes are like, but wait a minute, isn't vision really important for entrepreneurship? Aren't we supposed
to?
Don't
I have to walk in the door with a brilliant vision? Steve Jobs didn't ask his customers.
And Henry Ford didn't ask his customers. There is a kernel of truth to that idea that customers don't know what they want. Because they don't.
Dropbox, you use as an example in this book. They were all engineers. They couldn't explain to somebody what Dropbox was. to save their life.
Yeah.
You had to use it.
Exactly right.
So how do they solve that?
Well, so the Dropbox MVP is so cool. It's so simple. I tell this to engineers all the time, and they're like, no, that's too simple to work. It's like, wait, what? No, too simple is good.
Couldn't work.
Here's what they did. Before they had finished building their product, that Dropbox took about 2 years to build. It was a very complicated product.
Yeah.
The integration is amazing, so it was hard
Huge,
to build. So
yeah.
Before they'd finished that process, they created a video. And it's just this video. It's still on the internet. You can find it. They posted it to Dig, and it was just Drew narrating him using the product. And
even though there was no product.
There's no product. Doesn't the things that he's showing like sort of kind of work in the lab a little bit, but I mean it's not real yet, but it looks very polished. You can see the kind of magic thing, and in fact if you look carefully, all the files he's dragging around, they're all like Dig in jokes.
Oh, yeah.
It's all like funny. It's all funny stuff.
Brilliant, by the way. That's right. Smart.
Yeah.
Yep.
It was a way
know
for him
audience.
To go to a specific early adopter audience
yep.
and say, I feel you guys' pain, and let me show you a world, you know, the way I see it. And he invited people based on the video to sign up, basically to pre-order the early version of Dropbox. And they got, 10,000
I fell for
sign-ups.
It.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was, seemed real. And the great thing about early adopters is they don't mind
right.
being first to try
right.
a new incomplete product.
Yeah,
they
it's
love
important.
That.
So part of this culture is that you have a culture, an audience, a potential marketplace that's willing to put up with this crappy stuff you're shipping because they know that they're helping iterate along
exactly
with
right.
you.
Exactly
they're
right.
partners
that's the great
with
thing
you.
About early adopters is they actually prefer the 80% solution because
right.
it means they're getting it first. It's not the same. It's not ready for prime time. It's not the 100% thing that their grandma can use.
Google really realized
right.
that. Beta.
Yeah.
Beta.
They abused it.
I think there's a lot of people who...
Yeah,
they do.
We'll
there's a
that,
lot
yeah.
of people probably now reading the Steve Jobs book saying, aha, this is how you're an entrepreneur. You have a clear, driving vision. You ignore what everybody else tells you. You don't listen to your audience. You keep it a complete secret till it is a fully formed project, and then you reveal it to the world magically, and we're going to have 100 companies fail because they're trying to do
you think
this.
That's what Apple actually does, though? Because I feel like they fit what you're talking about, which is you put something out there, you see how people use it. I mean, Steve Jobs said, no apps. We're never doing apps.
Right.
But they realized,
moderate
that actually works.
And I think, I know a lot of entrepreneurs who want to be the next Steve Jobs.
Right.
I mean, I think it's going to be more than 100 companies.
Yeah.
It's going to
okay.
be, 100,000. But everybody, when they say, I want to be the next Steve Jobs, what they have in mind is the Steve launching the iPad. On the stage, world focused on him, president calling up, congratulate. Like, they forget the Steve Jobs that I admire, the Steve Jobs who launched the Apple One.
Right.
Right. The Apple One did almost, that was a hobbyist kit, put your own computer together. There was no apps, there's no iPhone, no iPad. I mean, it's a very simple, classic MVP. It was used by at most, I don't know, a few hundred, a few thousand
what's
people.
What's an MVP?
The minimum viable product.
Minimum viable product.
So it wasn't, you got to start with those small first steps before you get to be maybe 25 years later the guy on the stage that everybody loves.
Does it start, though, with an idea? I mean, does it start with the germ of it? There's 5,000, 20,000, actually more like 50,000 people watching. Probably half of them would like to start a company.
I hope they do.
So give them some direction. They have an idea.
Yeah.
Is that the first place you start? A scratch your own itch kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be. One thing I like about this model of entrepreneurship compared to certain other ideas that are out there is that you don't have to build for yourself necessarily. It's okay to build for somebody else. But if you're going to do that, you have to get to know that other person really well. You have to really be able to articulate clearly who is this product for and what are they going
to
use it for and
why.
It has
to scratch somebody's itch.
It has to scratch somebody's itch. But here's the thing. Most startup ideas are terrible. And that's actually not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the real stories, you go back and read the real stories of how entrepreneurs actually started, most of them started off with like pretty bad ideas.
Yeah, very
Twitter,
few of
Twitter's
them.
Twitter's idea is nothing like what we
right.
got.
Very few of them ended up doing what they said they were going to
Yeah, I mean, people always talk about Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg, the great visionary.
Oh, right.
People
yeah.
forget, right? Before there was Facebook, there was FaceMash, the thing that shows you compare farm animals and cartoons or whatever that was.
Yeah.
You wouldn't go back to Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room if you go back in time and say, Mark, listen, don't you launch that FaceMash. That's stupid. You got to have some vision, man. Let's spend the next 6 months. Months, 2 years. Let's do a strategic plan. Let's really think through. No, that's not what vision looked like. That would be the end of Facebook.
Right.
So the key is to take your bad idea. Just acknowledge there's probably something wrong with it. But inside of every bad idea is actually the kernel of a good idea waiting to be born.
Right.
So what we want to do is discover which parts of the idea are brilliant, which ones are crazy, and then we're going to chip away at the bad ones, revealing only the good that remains.
And you don't say do a focus group to figure that
Absolutely
stuff out.
Not.
And that's what everybody thinks about with Apple. Like, oh, they don't do focus groups. They don't listen to the audience. But you do take the audience into account, right?
Absolutely.
And after you put it out, you watch, because that's one of the signs of how your product is working.
You got it exactly right. Imagine I was a physicist, and I came in here, and I was like, guys, I'm trying to do science, but I have this problem. Electrons don't know what they want. I can't do a focus group with the protons, the electrons, so therefore I'm giving up and going home. You're like, what's wrong?
I'm going to tell the electrons what they want.
Or like, if you want to do alchemy, be like, I'll just tell them, listen, lead turn into gold. Right?
Yeah,
boom.
Exactly.
Like, neither of those is science. Science is you have a vision. You have a specific idea about something you think might work, and then you systematically try it using controlled experiments to figure out which parts of my idea are correct and which ones aren't. And I don't know, somehow in our pop culture, science has become like – has this connotation that it's routine or it's not creative, or it's like, hello, science is one of humanity's most creative pursuits. And so making entrepreneurship more scientific, I think, will be a great thing.
I've had people say that to me, like, you're treating this too scientifically. I'm like, no, that's a good thing.
What's wrong with that?
And that's where you're – I think one of the keys here is keeping those features slow or low so that you can tell how much of an effect they have. It's classic controlling for the variables.
You got it exactly right.
So we're talking to Eric Ries. He is the author of The Lean Startup, which is it's the hot title in Silicon Valley.
Thank you.
From Crown Business out right now. I mean, on the back of the book, Mark Andreessen, Mitch Kapor, Warren Bennis. And you won't even have a hashtag.
Of course I have a hashtag.
Pound Lean Startup.
How can you not?
We were talking before the show about the hashtagification of the world. So we're going to take a break, come back. But I want you to continue this process of helping our audience get their idea, their germ, to a product. Minimum viable product. And then iterate and fail and get better and maybe even make a success out of it.
I sure hope so.
Yeah. Before we do that, though, I want to tell you a little bit about our barbecue. We're having a barbecue. Isn't it going to be fun? You're going to come?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's your day off.
It's not far, though.
And
it's
food. You got to come. And it's food.
Barbecue food.
By the way, really good food. I don't know if it's going to be like ribs barbecue. I don't know. What is the menu?
I don't care how we spell it.
It's going to be good. Aaron Jones. Yeah, we misspelled it. Do you agree with me? It's not spelled with a Q?
No.
All right.
Unless you spell it B-B-Q.
Right.
Or something.
Well, you come from Texas. You should know that. It's by way of Missouri. But you should know this. Missouri has barbecue.
Great barbecue in St. Louis.
Fantastic, So anyway, the ad's for Ford, not barbecue. But it sounds like it's an ad for barbecue.
Right.
Because we know you love barbecue. Ford, however, is the sponsor. And so here's what's going on.
Come for the barbecue, stay for the Ford.
Stay for the Ford. We're going to have Ford vehicles there. We're going to have great food. But we only have room for 50. So there's two of these, 50 each, November 14th. Is that right? Or is it the 13th? November 13th.
November 13th, that's it.
And December 4th. At 1:30 p.m., we'll be here. The hosts of our new gaming show, Brian Brushwood and Veronica Belmont, will be here. The Fords will be here. The food will be here. It'll be so much fun. You can look for your brick on the wall. But we have to get you to go to twit.tv to request tickets. And if this goes well, I think we're going to do this in other ways, in other venues around the country. So, come if you can. We'd love to have you. Again, the 13th, a week from Sunday, and December 4th. And what you'll be seeing is these amazing Ford vehicles. Ford has really done something unheard of. I mean, here's an old line company. It was a startup once, but that was more than 100 years ago. How do you reinvent yourself? How do you keep up with the times? And, you know, I think a lot of companies can't do that. And when a company does it like Ford, it's really kind of wow. And I give a lot of credit to their CEO, Alan Mulally, who came in, an engineer, a guy who was all about process, about innovation, about electronics. He's the guy who did the 777 cockpit for Boeing. Just like a genius. Came in and said, we're going to reinvent this company from the ground up. First thing he did is said, we got to get on a good financial footing. I see tough times ahead. They never took a bailout from the government because Ford was very proactive in being financially sound. Next thing he did is he said, we got to take these cars into the 21st century. And that's where you get Ford Sync, My Ford Touch, where you get these amazing engines that give you great fuel economy and yet perform like muscle cars. I love my Mustang. I mean, it's incredible. And yet, I'm in the Mustang, and it's like Siri. 2 years ago, I pressed the button on the – very important, keep your eyes on the road, hands on the wheel, 10 and 2, right? And I press the button. And it goes, boom. And I say, play the Rolling Stones. It's so cool. And now they've got this new app link, so your smartphone ties into the Ford Sync, and you could say, play my Rolling Stones station on Pandora. You could say thumbs up or thumbs down to a song. You can literally press the button and say thumbs down. You could say, bookmark this song so you can buy it later. They have Stitcher. They have a thing called OpenBeak. This is just so cool. OpenBeak will read you your tweets. They do not let you tweet yet.
No, you can't post. But
I think that's appropriate. I don't want people driving down the road going, hashtag,
get
hashtag,
out of my way,
get out of
SUV.
My way. Wait a minute. Did I do something here? I can't hear. Am I okay? Oh, I must have sat on something. What was I saying? Oh, so OpenBeak, Stitcher, so you can listen to us. Michael Zapruder rap. I don't know what the hell that is.
I like his film.
That's interesting. So he's talking to his car. Okay, I just want you to understand that. He's talking to his car. Look, if you want to find out more, go to Ford.com/technology or come to the barbecue. There are all these great technologies. MyKey. So if you've got teenagers, I love this. It says you can't go faster than this and you can't turn the set. Turn down that stereo. It will only let the stereo go up to a certain level in the car. I love that. Isn't that great?
That's awesome. Yeah.
If it's too loud, I'm driving.
It's too loud. Ford.com/technology. Check out the app link on FordSync and the 2012 Ford Fiesta and other models. So we got a German idea. We know it's crap. Doesn't have to be good. We don't have to focus group test it. We just have to know that there's somebody who wants it and know that person pretty well, right?
Exactly.
If it's
right.
Not us, somebody else. What's the next step?
So instead of trying to find the answers, we're trying to figure out what questions to ask. So we don't need to know. Like, we say we want to know the customer, but we're probably wrong about who that customer is going to be, right? So we got to really be okay with that. The key is we have this concept we call build, measure, learn. It's a three-step feedback loop, very simple. I have an idea. I'm going to turn that idea into a product. I'm going to measure how people interact with that product to collect data. From that data, I'm going to impact my next set of ideas. We want to do everything we can to minimize the total time for that loop so we can go as fast as possible. That's the engine that really drives startups forward.
How do you know what to measure?
So, well, it goes back to what's your hypothesis. Whatever you believe.
So it's scientific method.
Exact scientific method. So if I'm working on, my idea is teleportation. Okay? Like, that's a pretty good idea, right?
Sure, so I love that.
That's what's great about teleportation is it's pretty easy to test if people want it. Okay? You don't have to really worry about that. But everyone thinks their idea is as good as teleportation. So I'm like, even if you're working on teleportation, let's just double check.
Yeah.
Right? All we're going to do is double
just
check. That's right. And
you
want to figure out, you know, the great thing about teleportation, since everybody should want it, it should be very easy to test. Well, I'm going to go offer 10 people the chance to pre-order my teleportation product. Theory says I should get 10 out of 10 people being like, yes, please, I cannot wait to get it. Okay, well, guess what? That's a prediction. That's 100% conversion rate. Excellent. Let's go run the experiment. And the great thing about the internet is no matter what business you're in, no matter what industry you're in, your customers are on the internet, and these experiments can be run really cheaply.
Right.
Because you only need, in a lot of cases, a couple hundred people to come to your website and give them the chance to pre-order and see what happens.
Dropbox is a perfect example.
Exactly.
They didn't have a product, but they made a video.
Yeah. People
see what happens.
If nobody has signed up for that video, that wouldn't have meant give up and go home. But again, it would be the double check. Something's not right. Right?
Yeah.
That product is so cool. That video is so cool.
What's
people
not
should
working?
Want it. Something.
Yeah.
Something's not quite right. And because most of the time we wind up building something that nobody wants, that's the first thing you always want to just double check. Make sure people actually basically want what you're doing. And if you pass that first test, then you can kind of keep going. Well, what are the next set of assumptions that are in my business plan?
I think the key point here, too, is that you're not going out and doing a survey. You're not asking people,
surveys,
do you think you want
groups.
This?
Exactly right.
Because
people
lie. People don't know what.
Idea.
And that goes back to the Apple thing. People don't know what they want, but you give them the opportunity to show that they want
exactly
it.
Exactly right. Yeah. To demonstrate through their behavior that you're right about them. That's all we're saying. Because fundamentally, a business is designed to change people's behavior in a good way. Now, sometimes the behavior we want to change is they will take their credit card out of their wallet and give it to us. Okay, that's a behavior. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's not about that. Or I think about something like Facebook. That's about getting customers to engage with the product so that they will become this, like, give you all this attention, which you can then resell to advertisers. So, like, anytime you get a product for free, you're the product, right?
Is Facebook kind of a poster child for this? I mean, it does seem like they iterate a lot, right?
I think they do a lot of these things. Now, here's the thing. The temptation when you become a professional expert like this is to want to claim that every company, you know, Apple, Facebook.
Yeah, right.
So the truth is, look, this is new. And what we want to do is take the techniques that I think the best companies have done kind of intuitively and make it more of a system so that it's more available to other people.
But I
do think that Facebook did a lot of things right, and especially one of the stories I tell in the book is actually about Facebook. When they first came to California, if you've seen the movie, like that is a kernel of truth. That's true. They really did move to a house in Palo Alto. Sean Parker really did run into him on the street. That's all real. And when they were in that house, they were able to raise money. I think they raised like $500,000 from Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel, yeah.
They had a couple thousand users.
Right.
And they were on a handful of college campuses. Their big numbers, what we call the vanity metrics, were really pathetically small. I mean, think about that. How could they raise so much money with such small numbers? Because they weren't focused on the vanity metrics. They were focused on what we call the actionable metrics, the real data that says what's going on, like the per-user behavior of each person on Facebook. The thing about Facebook that was so remarkable was two things. One, customers found it very valuable. How did they know? Because more than half would come back every day. Right? Very clear indication that they found it valuable. And two, you need to know how the product is going to grow. Facebook had a very very clear growth strategy, which was when they launch on a new campus, I think it's something like took them about 2 weeks on average to get 80% penetration of the whole campus.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Right? Incredible value, incredible growth. From those two numbers, you know, they were able to raise money. But not just that, and that's important not just because they could raise money, but that provided real concrete validation that you can't fake. Vanity metrics you could always fake with a Super Bowl ad or some other publicity stunt.
You can artificially pump them up.
But the nature of vanity metrics is they're expensive. So you're saying create an inexpensive, small-scale test that will give you valid measurements of your hypotheses.
And then
it's very scientific method.
We just make the test bigger and bigger and bigger as we get to more, you know, if we get to succeeding stages.
Do you explicitly suggest writing out your hypotheses, what you're going to test? I mean, I guess you, the more explicit you are about this,
I think so.
Clearer.
There are a lot of frameworks out there that people use to try and identify what are the key assumptions, and I'm agnostic as to which framework you use. You know, you can, if you went to business school, you were going to want to use the Michael Porter Five Forces Competitive Strategy. That's fine. You want to use business model generation. That's fine. There's all these different frameworks. The key thing is put yourself in a position to be wrong, because I have never once in my whole career, I've worked with thousands of entrepreneurs now, I've never been able to convince even one entrepreneur that their idea was wrong through argument.
Right.
It never works. Even if I'm right and their idea is really terrible and it violates every principle of sound strategy, doesn't work.
No, because I think success depends on belief, right?
And it does.
I have to really
believe. And the reason entrepreneurship is hard is you have to be able to hold two ideas in your head at the same time. One, I completely believe my idea is absolutely going to change the world. It's the most important thing in the entire universe. And also, my idea is probably fatally flawed and won't work at all. And how can you hold those two ideas at the same time? That creates cognitive dissonance. It literally gives you a headache.
Right.
And if you want to be an entrepreneur, all you have to do is be willing to put up with the headache.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is that simple.
Yeah.
But then, okay, I got the headache. Now what?
So that being an entrepreneur is a headache is literally true.
Oh, it is. It is. Listen, it is physically painful. I can attest to
that.
Here's
to the crazy ones, the headachey folks.
Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. You're going to have to be crazy to do it.
So when you're thinking of those two different possibilities and you're holding them in your mind, are you thinking of them that extreme, or is it more of like, you know, feeding back and forth between the two?
The truth is, emotionally, it tends to be the roller coaster.
Yeah.
You guys know. It's like one day you're convinced it's going to work, you finally made it, and the next day it's doom and gloom. And actually what we want to do, we want to create a context for entrepreneurs that's just more supportive. So that not that you're not going to go through those highs and lows, but that we can help keep the whole company focused on the long-term vision of where you're trying to go and waste less time debating and arguing and reading the tea leaves. Because when we work out in the book, I try to advocate for a system of quantitative assessment to demonstrate that you're making progress and prove it. Then you don't have to worry, am I making progress? Because we get the quantitative validation. We really are making progress.
You talk about Nick Swinmurn, who founded Zappos.
Yeah.
Nobody believed that. He didn't know. Would somebody buy shoes online?
Yeah.
Maybe they want to try them on. I don't know. So what did he do? He goes to shoe stores, takes pictures of shoes, says, look, if I can sell this online, I'll pay you full price. Would you let me take a picture of the shoe?
Yeah.
And basically, it's a made-up site where he puts pictures of shoes and validates his thesis.
Exactly right. And think about how much better that is than a focus group or market research. Because you're not asking people any questions. You're offering them, you're selling them a product, but you're also not doing anything hypothetical. This is not Kitchen of the Future, you know, concept video. This is a real product, real customers. And the great thing about it is not only can you test your assumptions that you thought you had, you can discover assumptions that you didn't even know you were making.
Well, this is what you say. It has to allow you to be surprised when customers behave in unexpected ways. For instance, and you might not have thought about this, what if they return them?
I know.
Now what?
Yeah.
So you have to have the space to allow these unexpected results in your experiment.
Exactly.
And then listen and act upon it, right?
And that's where the art and the judgment and the human part of entrepreneurship comes in, because what you run these experiments and then you have to interpret the results and you have to decide, we call it pivot or persevere, right? Am I on the right track
right.
or not. And if not, you know, where do I go next?
And there's no shame to pivoting.
There's no shame to pivoting.
In fact, it's a shame not to pivot if you have a crappy idea.
Yeah, I mean, if you're banging your head against the wall, you know, is the better part of valor is to go put your head somewhere else instead of waiting until it's a bloody pulp.
I think a lot of people, they get this like, okay, I'm going to observe. I'm going to do my best to look for data points that don't have bias in them so that I can bring that in. But when you find those law of unintended consequences. I don't know how many times I've had people in these sort of situations go, well, but why do they want to do that?
Yeah.
Or let's not let them do that. Let's push the audience around and make them do this. How do you get over that resistance, that natural hump, and say, no, we just have to reimagine and include this objectively? Mm-hmm. Don't make it personal. It's like, that's just the way they're going to act, and you can't change them. So how do you get to that point where you can incorporate it?
One thing is, actually, if someone wants to change human behavior, oftentimes these can come down to, my plan is to change human nature, and then.
That seems like a bad plan, but okay, go for it.
But you know what? That's the great thing about the double check. As an entrepreneur, everyone's always telling you your idea is bad. You don't want to listen. This gives you an alternative. Listen, we don't have to debate it. Let's find out what happens. Let's try to change the behavior. And sometimes the answer is you can, and sometimes the answer is you can't. And it doesn't matter in an abstract way who's right and who's wrong. It only matters, do I have the ability to do that? Can my company actually do that? So when we move beyond just being a single founder with an idea, we're actually trying to build an organization. That's why I say in the book, entrepreneurship is management.
That's a hard part.
This is hard.
The first step, everybody at home can say, oh, I get that, but design an experiment and test it and see if it works.
How hard could that be?
Now you got to build a company. That's really hard, right? Yeah, and there are, and they, unfortunately, there. I guess there's well-known rules for how to do it, but I don't know. It's
one of the things I was really surprised about in writing the book was how much of our modern management theory that teaches people how to build organizations was designed for a very specific context. Basically, 1920s Mad to Men. 1960s America.
Yes.
Which, you know, was a very dynamic time, so they thought at the time. But compared to today, it was a very stable business environment.
Yeah.
And so most management tools are based on fundamentally planning and forecasting.
Sure. It's the organization, man. It's the Peter principle. It's all of this stuff.
Drucker.
Yeah. And listen, and that stuff is great. And listen, look around. Every object you see in this room was manufactured using those principles. So I'm nothing wrong with that. But think about it. Planning and forecasting require a long and stable operating history from which to extrapolate
the
forecast.
We ain't got that. Yeah.
If you don't have that, then forecasting is not a tool that's available to you. Well, who feels like the world is getting more and more stable every day? Like, of course not. So those tools are becoming less and less relevant. And what I argue for in the book is that we need to develop a new toolkit, what I call entrepreneurial management, which is about how do you build an organization when you face these really uncertain times that we live in, or the fundamental uncertainty of building a new product that's fundamentally new.
Tell me, I need it. How, Eric? How? Tell me.
I got your attention. I love it. The best part about doing interviews with an actual entrepreneur instead of just a talking head is like,
okay,
you get into this stuff. It's like, wait, that sounds familiar. Yeah. Okay, let's do it. You know, I had somebody else. I actually got them to pivot their business while we were on the show. So
no kidding.
Yeah. So you know, let's see what we can
I'm
do.
I'm sure Jim Latterbeck was very grateful to you for that.
No comment.
Just
no
kidding.
No comment to make it.
Just kidding. And by the way, you have not yet said anything about raising money.
That's right.
Why not?
It's actually not a very interesting topic. I mean, it's complicated. It has its own set of complexities. And sometimes people think lean means don't raise money or raise money. But really, lean is about taking whatever resources you have available to you and using them more efficiently. So it's an orthogonal question whether you raise a lot of money or a little bit of money. It's not really directly relevant. And entrepreneurs often get sucked into – I mean, read entrepreneurship topics online.
That's all they talk about.
Everybody's all about raising money. It's like, how do I convince this gatekeeper or that gatekeeper?
Well, it's the oxygen that fuels the fire, right?
Yeah.
But it isn't really.
It doesn't have to be. And I think that the problem with the way we're doing fundraising today in general and the whole ecosystem is basically based on pattern recognition, right? I'm looking for the next Mark Zuckerberg, the next Mark. But like, pattern recognition is just a fancy word for bias.
Right.
So – and if you understand the patterns that are being recognized as an entrepreneur, you can game the system.
It's easy to get money.
By trying to make yourself
a lot harder to make a good startup.
Like, yeah, exactly right. So I think every ounce of energy I put in – that people put into what I call success theater, like putting on this show, putting on the black turtleneck, trying to be
–
like that's energy that could have been spent building a great company and serving customers.
I love that.
And so – I think our attention, we get way distracted by the shiny object. And if you look, I mean, again, I always go back to Mark Zuckerberg because when he came to Palo Alto, he was not some polished fundraising guy. I mean, He didn't know, you know, he didn't know how to raise money. He didn't, but he had the data, the numbers.
He had the value metrics and the growth metrics.
Exactly,
he knew.
Right. He could demonstrate this is something amazing. Yep. And because of that, not only could he raise money, he had the leverage to insist on really cool terms.
Right.
So all the ninja stuff you read about online about how to create a great term sheet, all that stuff doesn't matter if you don't have the leverage to do it. And you get leverage two ways. You can either be, have great social proof and be, you know, have a great background and be a certain, or you can have the data that shows that you're actually making something that matters. And boy, I would much rather have the latter than the former.
So really, this is the data-driven startup in, yeah, in many ways.
It's, absolutely.
Yeah. Be driven by data. Yeah.
It, I mean, I just, I'm gonna go along with that, but I'm just going to just repeat one thing, which is that sometimes people hear data-driven and they think that means no vision. And if you're just doing experiments, if you use the word experiment to
you need a hypothesis before you can do an experiment.
Right. Vision first.
Albert Einstein, Richard Feynman, all these huge scientists, they all had vision that led them to say, well, let me see if this works. Let me test this. Let me explore this.
Part one of the book is called Vision. I mean, that really is the first, that is the foundation upon which all entrepreneurship is built. But then it's like vision, then what? Right? You can't just will the world to be the way you want it to be, despite all the stuff you read about that. That is not true. You can convince other people about that, but that is not true. You have to actually make sure that the elements of your vision that require specific things to be true are in fact true. And when we go and get into more detail, we really try to differentiate your vision, which is where you're trying to go, the change you want to see in the world, is separate from the strategy by which you will achieve that vision, separate from the product that you sell to customers.
That's a very good
product,
point.
Product, strategy, vision.
Because I think a lot of people think, well, my vision is the end product. It's the whole thing.
Right. And it isn't. When push comes to shove, most entrepreneurs will realize, oh, I can let this go because I really wanted to do this other thing. So, you know, you look at when Groupon made the pivot from The Point, the petition site, to social coupons, you know, in retrospect, it kind of, you can kind of see the connection. You'd be like, oh, they were interested in this kind of group empowerment, collective action. But like, on the
face of it, big pivot.
It's a pretty big pivot.
It's equivalent to the Flickr people going from gaming to a photo sharing site.
Yeah, or the Odeo guys becoming Twitter.
Right.
From the outside, it often seems like there's nothing going on. But if you're there in the moment, you will always find there's a certain continuity of vision between the products. And I like Groupon especially because, you know what their first Groupon was?
Mm-mm.
Okay, the very first Groupon was actually 2-for-1 pizza in the pizza restaurant in the lobby of their building. When I was in Chicago on a book tour, I got to eat at that pizza
restaurant. They tested
it. It's still there.
They tested it.
Okay, 20 people redeemed the coupon.
Yeah.
There was no technology. There was a WordPress blog that they reskinned to say Groupon, and they were literally on their laptops emailing all the coupons, PDFs that they made on the laptop. That was it to those people. And now, I understand you guys, if you had been there, you would have been like, oh, 20 free pizzas? That's a $1 billion business.
Right.
So obvious.
Who wouldn't have thought of that?
Who would have thought of that?
Yeah. Right.
But the reason they were able to understand how powerful that was is because they had spent a year
trying to get that,
trying
kind
to get
of,
that other thing to work.
Is like, this virality we're talking about, is that key to this?
It's one of the three what I call engines of growth. People think that if you have a great product, it just grows itself, you know, through word of mouth. And that really isn't true. Growth is something that has to be engineered, especially if you want hypergrowth, the kind of growth that powers Groupon and Facebook and Google and these kind of companies. And I want us to be focused as entrepreneurs on sustainable growth. And sustainable growth means that new customers come from the actions of past customers.
Oh, I like that.
Right? Either through direct viral engagement, so your PayPal, Facebook, or because the past customers are coming back themselves and becoming your new customers through some kind of repeat retention-based business, your World of Warcraft, your cell phone company, right, your subscription-based businesses, or the revenue that the past customers generated, you can invest into advertising. So that's what we call the paid engine of growth. So the three engines of growth: viral, sticky, paid. And each of those engines, it works like a feedback loop. And the faster the loop turns, the faster your growth will be. And it allows you to identify the key critical few metrics that really matter for your business. So if you're trying to build a new World of Warcraft, what matters is the engagement rate. How addictive is the product? You know, how many people come back? It doesn't matter how easy it is to get into the product. If you've ever tried to install World of Warcraft, it takes like 4 hours and 92 CDs.
It's play it, I have to do 100 updates.
Yeah, patches and all that.
Listen, I can't play again because it's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to start playing right now.
People will go all the way through.
Addictive is a very good marketing strategy, by the way.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Whereas, let's say you're building a dating site.
That's sticky. That's what you would call sticky.
You're building a dating site. If you have a dating site with high retention, something seriously wrong.
Customers
don't want to be on the dating site. They want to get off the dating site.
So
it really, you have to really understand what is my
theory
of growth.
Depends on your market. But yeah, most of the time, right?
Listen, the kind of dating sites we're talking about today. So it's about really understanding why are people in your product, how is it going to create value for them, and then how is that value going to turn into growth? And that can help you answer questions. Like people are always like, you should charge money for your product from day one. It's like, really? Because what if Facebook had followed that advice?
Right. It would
have been a disaster. So no, not necessarily. Only in certain engines of growth is how much you charge customers a key leap of faith assumption. In others, it kind of doesn't matter.
Sounds like being an entrepreneur really is a lot. There's a lot of thinking involved.
Yeah.
There's a lot of taking some time and thinking about your stuff. It sounds like a very cerebral act, oddly enough.
It's tricky. When you slow it down in order to really analyze the components like we're doing now, it sounds cerebral and calm and very rational. But you know, when you're in the heat of the moment,
when you're driving the train,
it is so fast and things are going crazy. So that what's happening is the reason I think it's important to slow it down and really get this theory right is so that people can get better at it. So that when they're in the moment, they don't have to be like thinking about
it's
it for the first time. They can develop those instincts and judgment.
Yeah.
And the lesson, the number one lesson of the scientific method is that although we rely on judgment as human beings, we can train our judgment to get better over time by making testable predictions. Because when you fail, you can learn.
Right.
And the converse of that is that if you can't fail, you can't learn.
Right.
So people who have the idea that I'm going to just ship it and see what happens never learn. Why? Because you're guaranteed to succeed at seeing what happens. Right? Something's going to happen sure, but then what?
So you, ahead of time, want to say...
You want to make a prediction of what's supposed to happen so that you can be wrong. You can have, you know, what we call a falsifiable hypothesis in the fancy language of
It's kind of like a safety net. You're putting bumpers on your perception so that you don't bias your results by saying, well, that's exactly what I thought would happen. No, you got to say that ahead of time.
Exactly. Anyone who's ever used Google Analytics knows Eric's law of Google Analytics, which is no matter how badly you are screwing up at any time, there is always at least one graph.
One metric that looks
that's
great.
That's up and to the right. So you just pull that one out of your deck.
Look
you
how good we're
board,
doing.
Look, we're up and to the right on this thing I never heard of before, you know.
You know, I want to ask you what you were saying about growth and sustainable growth. Particularly, I feel like that goes back to the financial aspect where people are so focused on the money because they feel like, well, I have to grow and I have to grow fast, so I need money for that, which then leads them to having a bunch of people who say, show me how you're growing so that I can see my investment. How do you get off that treadmill and be able to focus on sustainable growth?
It goes right to the heart of the question, why do you become an entrepreneur? Because if your goal in building a startup is to make money, you got serious problems.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's not a very good way to make money. Okay, go work at Goldman Sachs, for God's sake. There are way better ways to make money. Well, easier ways, I should say.
Sure.
Easier ways to make money. But also, a company that exists to make money, the so-called shareholder value theory of the company, can never make any decisions. Because how do you know, you know, if
you're chasing your tail every moment.
It's like A or B. And pretty much, if you're just like split testing and experimenting, just like all I want to do is make more money, within 5 minutes, you'll be selling porn.
Right.
Right. Like you just
you're, want you're, to, right. you're honest about
if you really
it,
want to optimize for porn. That's a guarantee.
Like, that's what you're trying to do. And you feel
it.
That pressure.
You heard Godwin's law? We got Reese's law here. It all comes down
all
to
comes
that.
Down to porn.
So no, you're right though.
Help
Absolutely.
People get out of that trap. And that's why.
So what should you want?
Well, so this is now where it gets a little bit complicated. In the book, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about the need for an accounting revolution. It's like accounting. Is there anything more boring in the whole world?
We're going to take a break right now,
exactly.
And we'll get back to accounting.
Go ahead. But the truth is, a lot of our problems stem from the way we account for progress in startups.
Right.
And in order to get off that treadmill, we really have to get serious about what is progress. If it's not the vanity metrics, if it's not just profitability and ROI, well, what the hell
what
is it? What is it? So what we want to do,
we
identify those actionable non-vanity metrics that are related to our engine of growth, like take their viral coefficient.
Right.
How fast is my viral loop turning over? Right? So that's the key number. Now, product market fit for a viral business is a viral coefficient greater than 1.0, right? You know, that's when an epidemic goes super linear, is when for each person that comes in, more than one of their friends comes with them,
right.
And then more one of them, and then it goes crazy. So when you're trying to build a viral business, the first time you run the experiment, you're going to have a viral coefficient. It's not going to be 1.0.
No.
It's going to be like 0.1.
Right.
And you're going to be depressed.
Right.
And that's not going to work. A viral coefficient 0.1 means you're not going to grow. You're going to shrink. People at that point get tempted to like want to throw money at the problem and do press and launch and hope to jump. But that actually doesn't help the fundamental aspect of the product, which is how viral is the product itself.
Mm-hmm.
So each cohort of customers that come into our product, maybe each week or each month, we want to measure what are those key numbers. Those are key conversion rates, those key viral coefficient. And sometimes the numbers will go like this. Like, let's say you want it to be 1.0 and it starts at 0.1. Sometimes it'll be like, in 1 month it'll be 0.1, then 0.3, then 0.7, and you're like, right? Because I feel we're getting there, we're making progress. And you're not at 1.0 yet, you're not done, but you can really say, you know, we're going to make it this year. And then sometimes it goes like this. It's like 0.1, and you jump up to 0.5, and it's great. And it's like 0.5, 0.55, 0.575, 0.57575, you know? And I meet teams that are trapped in the land of the living dead, mm-hmm. because even though they're hitting an obvious point of diminishing returns, it's still up and to the right.
Yeah.
So they still feel like they should keep going. And again, it goes back to that habit.
So when do you decide to pivot? What is it that you need to...
There's no hard and fast rule, but I think the number one indicator is that feeling of diminishing returns.
Right.
Like, most of
us are...
It's still growing. It's still up and to the right.
But
when you can see the
growth of the growth isn't enough.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Right. So it's the engine is still turning. I mean, a lot of companies, when I ask them, are you making progress? They're like, well, sure I am. I'm like, well, how do you know? Well, we made these awesome features last month, and this month our numbers are higher than last month. Right. Therefore, QED, you know, it's... And I'm like, interesting. If you guys all took a month off and just... company-wide month-long vacation, except for the sales and customer service team, all product development month off, would your numbers be up and to the right? And they're like,
yep.
Sure, of course. Because, like, you know, word of mouth, it's still going
on. It just happens.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. It happens. We got great SEO and all this. Yeah. So it's like, okay, so you're telling me that if you took a vacation, you'd make it just as much progress as you... And they're like, whoa, but. And it's like, hold on.
Yeah.
I have a better theory. My theory is that Mercury was in retrograde last month. And I heard through astrology that when Mercury is in retrograde, all numbers go up. That's my... And people, especially engineers, right? Scientists, they get mad at me.
Oh, you can't do that.
You're crazy. I don't believe in astrology. I'm like, well, listen, I'm just visiting, but you live here.
Yeah.
And which of us... Neither of us knows whether you're... Not, like, we don't know what cause and effect. So we got to get out of that kind of throwing darts at a dartboard, or like this kind of voodoo momentum theory of what causes... No, we want to really get down to true cause and effect. And when you do that, when you really look at it that way, the problem with the diminishing returns becomes painfully obvious.
Yeah.
Because you're still working hard. You're doing just as much work to get a crappy experiment as a successful experiment. Because productivity in a startup is not about how much stuff you make. It's not about how much energy you invest, right? It's how well what you're doing matches with what customers can accept, right? It's the results you get.
But why does it have to grow at an exponential rate? I mean, you could just match what customers want, and there we go. We're done.
I think that's true. I mean, if you don't do anything, if you just leave the product, if you have a good product and it just basically works, you will get linear growth just through word of mouth.
It'll happen before you.
And if that's all you want, like you're building a lifestyle business and you found your niche and you... That's great, but then let's just admit that's what's going on, and let's stop tinkering with the product.
Right.
If it works and we're satisfied, that's great. But what happens is, we're human beings, we can never resist tinkering.
Right.
And yet most teams that I meet do not know if they are busy making their product better or worse.
Right.
Would a little calculus help them? Just look at acceleration, not velocity.
I just like to announce that we are going to pivot to a bicycle store on tomorrow. The book is The Lean Startup. Eric Ries is the author. We'll have more with Eric in just a bit. Let's talk about a business that could probably use some help from you, Eric, right now. Netflix. Netflix is our sponsor, so don't be mean. No, but I think, you know, this is the other problem. We'll talk about it. It's not always in your hands. There are other forces besides you and your customers, and Netflix is an example where they are in an interesting position. And I think they're making a pivot. I don't think people understand, but this is a pivot. They're going to streaming. And instead of... They were the DVD mail company, but they have an amazing streaming business. And by creating content, buying content, they are finding a way to, I think, survive in a hostile environment.
Well, they weren't always a DVD my mail company. They pivoted before.
What were they before that?
I'm trying to remember what they were, but when they first started...
It wasn't DVD by mail.
It wasn't rental DVD. They sold DVDs.
They sold them over the internet.
Interesting.
No problem.
Well, here's the deal. Go to netflix.com/twit, and for $7.99 a month, you can watch like all this great stuff, like Mad Men, these documentaries, these classic movies, these brand new movies. It's an amazing... I was watching a Nicolas Cage movie that came out this year, The Season of the Witch. You ever see that?
No.
Good for Halloween.
Really?
Scared the crap out of me. Anyway, you never know what you're going to find on Netflix. Looks great. Plays on all the devices. In fact, I just set up the Google TV again, and it looks great on that. Yeah, that was the movie. I'm not saying it was a great movie, but here's the beauty. Here's the beauty part. It didn't cost me anything to watch it. $7.99 a month, and I'll tell you, I'll make it even a better deal for you. Your first month's free if you go to netflix.com/twit. Netflix.com/twit. You're going to love it. it is really a great deal in entertainment. But it is an interesting point. You don't always have control of market forces, right? Sometimes, as in Netflix's case, your suppliers, the movie companies, decide they want to put you out of business.
Yep.
What do you do then, huh?
And that's the thing. That's why the concept of pivot is so important. I mean, it's kind of an overused buzzword. I mean, really, I'm sorry, but it's just how it is. A pivot is not necessarily mean. First of all, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
That's, by the way, kind of one of the reasons that we are in an amazing entrepreneurial environment is not only is it inexpensive to be an entrepreneur, but failure is not anymore a stigma.
That's right.
It's understood that that's part of it. In Europe, you go to Europe, failure not good. You have failures on your resumes. It's bad. But here, we understand that's part of the deal.
Fail faster.
Yeah, fail faster.
Interesting. If you look at the academic research, there's a bunch of academics out there who are trying to study entrepreneurship. And the research isn't so great, but there's a few things they've studied well. And one of them, they've been trying to test this claim about failure. And the academics are frustrated because they're like, you know, statistically speaking, entrepreneurs who've failed are not any more likely to be successful than ones that haven't failed before.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, it's not the failure that
makes them successful.
Right? It's what you learn from the failure. And if you're stubborn and you just do the same thing over and over again and you do five failed businesses in a row, it's the same
business.
That's
me. I just keep doing this. Right? I keep – one of these days it'll work. I'm just going to keep doing it. Yeah, what about the innovator's dilemma? Do you –
yes.
Mean, this is a classic. Do you deal with that issue?
It is. It is – because one of the most controversial things I've been saying is that entrepreneurship is not about being in a small company. I have a definition of a startup. My definition.
You could be an entrepreneur in any business.
It's like, right, it's a human institution designed to create something new under conditions of extreme uncertainty. That's all it is.
Love it.
So a lot of people thought they were getting a safe job in a safe company in a safe industry. And then all of a sudden they discovered, guess what? There's no such thing anymore.
Yeah.
And I call them involuntary entrepreneurs.
Right.
They didn't sign up to be an entrepreneur, but guess what? You're now tasked with dealing with this innovator.
I think I've been telling the high school my kids are in, you got to teach entrepreneurship.
Absolutely.
Because no matter what these kids do when they graduate, they are going to be facing an environment where exactly that. They have to continually invent
themselves.
It's got
to be part of the foundation of this new social contract as a society that we are busy negotiating right now. Because the institutions that supported us for the past century.
Can't count on them.
You know, they're not well adapted to the current environment, which is too chaotic, requires a lot more individual initiative.
Right.
But the great part is, it's also going to be a lot more creative,
right?
Because routine work is going to go away.
Right.
Anything that can be automated will be automated. So if something can be done by robots, it's going to be done by robots. And there's no earthly reason human beings should be doing something boring. The asset, the advantage we have, so many people on this earth, they have so much creativity and talent and ingenuity to give. What we have to do is create systems and structures that harness that ingenuity and creativity for a better purpose.
Certainly no one watching this network should be flipping burgers. They all have that opportunity because everybody who's watching this network cares enough about this stuff. They care. They're watching. They're involved.
They know a lot more than they think.
They are natural entrepreneurs. So that's the thing is, how do we get to that?
It's not even just teaching entrepreneurial thinking. What I love about your approach is it's teaching critical thinking.
Yeah,
it's scientific.
And I think that's what's
I love
really
it.
Important.
I love the scientific
method. I would issue this challenge to everybody watching right now, which is I know every single one of your viewers has an entrepreneurial idea in the back of their mind. I know it. They're like, I could have thought of that.
Yep.
Whatever it is, the assignment is test the idea tomorrow.
Love it.
24-hour challenge. Okay, that's it. Don't spend a month, a week, a year, one day challenge.
That's so great.
And you don't have to. It doesn't have to be the greatest, fullest thing, but any idea, you can get the first validation in 24 hours. That's an eternity on the internet today.
Absolutely.
And I think anyone has to spend more than $100 on their experiment, like, you know, it's doing too much. So
right.
A minimum viable product, $100 budget max, 24 hours, make it happen.
Love it.
And then read the book. The
Lean. Obviously, you could save $24.
You'd be crazy not to read the book first. Eric Ries.
That's awesome.
And it is called The Lean
Thanks
Startup.
For the plug,
I appreciate it. Eric, really great stuff. I wish I could keep you around for another couple of weeks, maybe years, and you could show us everything we're doing wrong here, because I know we are. But that's maybe for another time. Do you work? You work with the Harvard folks. Do you work with any startup schools or incubators or anybody like that?
I've done some stuff with Techstars, and I've obviously spoken a lot of the incubators. But
right.
I try.
Is that a good method? You think? I mean, this is really what's going on now. I guess it all started with Paul Graham.
Yeah.
And Y Combinator, but this is really kind of neat. You can learn this stuff.
It's incredible. And Paul deserves tremendous credit for pioneering Y Combinator, and in particular for encouraging people who wouldn't have otherwise become entrepreneurs to take the plunge, right?
Yeah.
Creating a credentialed, prestigious thing that you could do as an alternative to graduate school if you're a smart person who graduated from a top school. And that has pulled a huge wave of talent into the entrepreneurship ecosystem. And the fact that all these guys have copied him has just created all these more entrepreneurial opportunities for people. So I do think that, you know, I think that's really, really an awesome thing.
To me, this is the thing that makes me the most optimistic. I'm basically a pessimist. I think the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But we are in the most innovative time ever and the most opportunity for anybody to do this ever. And it's so exciting to see the ferment, the foment, the things that are happening, the bubbling stew of innovation. And it's great. It's amazing. And it's happening in this country primarily. And I think, you know, we're going to Le Web in December to talk to European entrepreneurs who are saying, how do we do this here? This everybody realizes this is the future for the planet Earth.
Yeah. It's time to get serious about
it. We need it.
Because if we're just – we have the tools. The technology has made possible this democratization. So we're going to have – orders of magnitude more startups active than at any previous time in history.
Absolutely.
But if we use the same old outdated models for running those startups, we're not going to improve the success rate at all. We're just going to wind up with a ton more failure.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that would be a criminally negligent waste of people's time and energy. So I think we could do better.
Eric Ries, the Lean Startup. Thank you, Eric.
Pleasure to be
here. Great to meet you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for watching. I know every time we do triangulation, I say this. That was really great. I'm learning so much. It's so much fun. Tom Merritt, thank you for helping me make this show work. And thanks, everybody, for watching. We do triangulation whenever we can find somebody of Eric's stature, which is most Wednesdays, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC at twit.tv. You don't have to watch live. It's nice if you do because we pay attention to the chat room. But you can always watch the shows. We make audio and video recordings available for download on our site. And, of course, everywhere podcasts are, like iTunes and the Zoom Marketplace and all of that. Who's next week? Do we know? Bree Pettis.
Hey.
Oh, MakerBot. All right. That's going to be a lot.
He's going to make that manufacturing system even easier.
Oh, yeah. Talk about renting the pizza production.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Thank you, Eric. Very cool. Thanks, Tom. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.